From the home of the Codebreakers and the birthplace of modern computing, this is the Bletchley Park podcast. Welcome to the December 2014 edition of the Bletchley Park podcast. This has been a landmark year for Bletchley Park, with the completion of Phase 1 of the restoration, crowned by a visit from Her Royal Highness the Duchess of Cambridge. More recently, the release of the hit film about Alan Turing, The Imitation Game, has brought this amazing story to the attention of whole new swathes of people. In this episode, we hear from Benedict Cumberbatch, who plays Alan Turing in the film, about how nerve-wracking, special, and even ghostly it was filming scenes at Bletchley Park. We also take you to the special screening at Bletchley Park, which launched The Imitation Game, The Exhibition. We give you a peek into 2015 with a look at upcoming events, and we hear from veteran Kathleen Wing, an intercept operator from 1944 to 45. But first, the Turing test is an underlying theme of the film The Imitation Game, and it's still confounding computer scientists to this day. Dr. Hugh Loebner has turned that into a competition, which he's been running for more than two decades, putting software under very human scrutiny. For the second time, it was hosted here at Bletchley Park.
Good machines ever think as human beings do?
Most people say not.
You're not most people.
Well, the problem is you're asking a stupid question.
I am?
Of course machines can't think as people do. A machine is different from a person. Hence they think differently. The interesting question is, just because something thinks differently from you, does that mean it's not thinking? We allow for humans to have such divergences from one another. You like strawberries, I hate ice skating, you cry at sad films, I am allergic to pollen. What is the point of different tastes, different preferences, if not to say that our brains work differently, that we think differently? And if we could say that about one another, then why can't we say the same thing for brains built of copper and wire, steel?
And that's this big paper you wrote. What's it called?
The Imitation Game.
Right, that's what it's about.
Would you like to play?
Hi, my name's Dr. Ed Keedwell from the Computer Science Department of the University of Exeter, and I'm the organiser of the Loebner Prize this year.
I'm Hugh Loebner. I'm from New York, and I'm the sponsor of the contest.
So I don't know who's best to answer this, but what made you want to have it here?
Well, I think this is the ideal place. The Loebner Prize is really the imitation game. It's the Turing test, but the Turing test is the imitation game, and I think this is as closely allied to Turing and his memory as any place is. And so there's, I think, of no better place to have it here.
Mm-hmm. And I gather in the past it's been in your apartment.
Oh, it's been everywhere just about, yeah. Technically, it's not a very difficult contest. It's a parlor game. But yes, it's been in my apartment 3 years. It's been held at Dartmouth, a lot of places. But I earnestly hope that it has a permanent home here.
And Ed, how significant is the Turing test still today in the development and progress of AI?
I think that the fact that we haven't been able to pass it yet, I think, is a really good indication of how difficult the test is. And I think it's something in particular, the idea of general AI, so the idea that you can ask any question that you want, which is part of Turing's original test and part of the Loebner Prize today, is really significant. I think AI has made great strides in other areas, in sort of more confined areas. So a lot of our phones and gadgets and things all have AI built into them. But getting this sort of general AI, something that's very human-like, is proving very difficult.
I would say that any program that could pass the Turing test could probably pass almost any other test of artificial intelligence, although the reverse is not true.
How much of a visionary was he?
Oh, incredible. I mean, if you read his article on computing and machine intelligence, at the end he says we buy the computer the best sense organs money can buy and teach it in the manner of a child. Well, that's years ahead of most people's thinking today, you know. It's incredible how perspicacious, prescient he was. Is that the term? A very, very, very smart guy and very, very visionary.
And how did you get interested in his work in the first place?
Mostly I was very lazy, and I've always wanted computers to do all the work. I mean, really, almost before high school. And they always said, well, you can't do that. The computer would have to be as big as the Empire State Building and require all the water in Niagara Falls to cool it off. Well, you don't hear that anymore. I was working at the Department of Employment Security in Massachusetts, and I came upon a program that I thought would be useful in trying to pass the Turing test. It was a compiler, but it allowed regular expressions and things. And I said, gee whiz, you know, I could write a program that could pass the Turing test with this. I mean, I'm deluded, but that doesn't matter. And I realized at the point, though, that there was no place to enter a Turing test passing program. So I said, well, why not? And I asked my father, I said, Dad, we should do this. I was at Crown Industries. I thought it would be pretty interesting that contest for the cutting edge of artificial intelligence, the funds would come from the sale of roll-up plastic lighted portable disco dance floors, which is what Dad did. And he said, oh, damn it, when I'm dead, you can do it. I mean, he was not very enthusiastic about my ideas. And so when he died, I did it.
Later that day.
No, about 3 years later. Dr. Epstein, who had worked with me at University of Maryland, Baltimore County, founded a nonprofit organization in Cambridge, Massachusetts. And he came down on a postdoc to Rockefeller University, and we had dinner. I said, you know, Robert, it'd be interesting to have a Turing test contest. And Robert said, phew, that's a wonderful idea. Let my organization do it. And I never really understood what the purpose was for his organization, but I thought it would give it a purpose. I said, sure, Robert. And he did a good job until they kicked me out.
Oh, dear.
It's been a very interesting story. I mean, in 1994, the Loebner Prize Committee resigned in protest because they didn't like the rules, although they were their rules. In 1995, Marvin Minsky, the doyen of artificial intelligence, offered $100 to anybody who could get me to end the prize, quit the
imploding.
Prize.
Imploding.
Well, yes, as a matter of fact. Although
that's because I think that happens where people care passionately about a subject, doesn't it?
I have no idea. I
was feel just an ownership thing. Of it, don't they?
And, yeah, absolutely.
And that's how people fall out, don't they?
Yeah, I'm afraid they do, yeah. Part of it is that we haven't had something that can pass the Turing test yet, and there have been various other sort of more narrow tests that people have proposed during that time, haven't there? There's various different Winograd tests and those kind of things.
I'm sort of an abrasive personality, I've been told. That might have had something to do with it. To be honest, you know, honesty in all things.
We're quite early in the day here. It hasn't quite got going yet, so we'll obviously come back to talk to you a bit later and see how it's turned out. But what are you hoping for?
It's been very good so far in terms of obviously the media interest has been huge. Bletchley Park, obviously, with its sort of brand new face on, is fantastic. So it's a great facility to have the Loebner Prize again. So maybe we'll see a winner this year. I don't know.
No, we'll see a winner.
Well, we'll see. No, maybe we'll see the silver medal.
No, I don't think so. But what I want to see is a winner. Yep. I mean, not a silver prize, but a non-controversial, clear and distinct winner.
Yep.
That's the highest priority, that the contest goes on and somebody is declared the winner.
Yep.
Which has happened every year, usually with not too many problems.
By 4 o'clock, it's all over by the shouting then.
Yeah. So the actual sort of contest itself takes a couple of hours. So from about 1:30, we think it's going to be about 2 hours, maybe a bit more. And at the end, the judges tot up their results as to who they think was the most human-like in terms of the AI bots. And then we add up the rankings and declare a winner.
Well, good luck.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
May the best bot win.
It's not predetermined, so if you ask the same question twice, you should technically get a different answer, or maybe a... Sorry, you've already answered that, what you want to ask. Well, anyway, your definition of consciousness, but...
It's not your first visit to Bletchley Park. Tell me, how far back does that go? When did you first become aware of this place?
Oh, crikey, I've been aware of it for a long time, and I've been here several times, and I can't really remember when the first one was, but it was a while back, and it looked very different then.
You must be pleased to see it sort of thrive and come on so far.
Yeah.
You've taken an interest.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. I mean, it's fantastic. There's a surprising amount of stuff to see here, given that it was secret, nobody knew about it, and most of it was dismantled immediately after the war. It's surprising how much stuff has been recovered and put on display. I think it's probably the least secret place in the world now, isn't it?
Yes, exactly. No longer a secret, we like to say. So artificial intelligence is the thrust of what today's competition is all about. What's your sort of entry point into that? How do you see it?
Well, it's not something I know a huge amount about, but I have friends who do. I've got a mate who's a professor of computer science. He talks to me about artificial intelligence a lot, accuses me of having it even. And I wrestle with the idea that it's not just can a machine think, it's not just that, it's can we actually replicate what we call intelligence, which is a very analysed thing, but which for me overlaps with the idea of being human, being conscious, and I suppose having a soul, if the soul exists, whatever that is, but it definitely means something that I'm not sure is understandable or can be replicated.
Can't be pinned down in that way.
No, because you have to be able to define it to, well, this is the way my maybe slightly creaky brain works, but you have to be able to define it in order to replicate it, which is true of a diagram of a triangle as well, you know.
It's sort of intangible, isn't it? Because it means something different to different people.
Yeah, well, as is the way with science, a question usually leads to another question. Otherwise, I suppose science would have stopped by now. But once you say, is there such a thing as machine intelligence? You then start wrestling with the question, actually, what is intelligence? We have to know what it is if we're to identify it, but you have to define it to identify it. So you end up going down all these other avenues. It's insoluble almost. It's so complicated, but it's worth banging your head against.
We've
got
to keep probing, haven't we? We've got to keep trying. So you're judging today. What are you looking for?
Well, I suppose I'm sort of seeing this as a bit of a challenge to me as much as to the machine, because I think it's a bit like playing that, you know, the on the head game where you have the name of a famous person from history stuck
yes.
on your head, but you don't know who you are.
Yeah.
So you work it out by asking other people questions. The skill of that game is in how you ask the questions.
Yeah.
And I think that might be the skill of this as a test. It's how the tester does the testing, i.e. what you ask of the human or the robot.
Yeah, how can you make a judgment if you're not asking, probing it well enough and asking
exactly.
the right kind of question. Hugh did say it started out as a parlour game and he used to
yeah.
run this in his apartment. So it really is just a very sort of complicated parlour game now, isn't it?
It is an extremely complicated parlour game. That's a good way of thinking of it. And that's why I think it has some critics as well. Some people say it's actually just a stunt. It's not entirely relevant to the development of machine intelligence and robotics and autonomy and all these other things. But I'm not sure I buy that. I can see why it has critics, and I'm sure it's not perfect, but it goes back to what Babbage said about data, and incomplete data is still better than no data, isn't it? So there you go, we've got a bit of incomplete data, but that's a start.
Dr. Bertie Muller from the University of South Wales, and I'm the chair of the AISB.
Tell me a bit about the AISB, first of all.
So the AISB is a Society for the Study of Artificial Intelligence and Simulation of Behaviour. It's the oldest artificial intelligence society in the world, founded 50 years ago, so we're in our 50th anniversary year this year. And we promote research in the area of artificial intelligence. We have an annual convention that attracts hundreds of researchers and people from industry. We also organise a workshop series, and we try to promote young scientists.
Development in this field must be pretty rapid.
It is rapid in parts, but in other parts, if you look at the Turing test, for example, this has been around since 1950, and essentially, since we have not had an AI program that has been able to pass at least the Loebner Prize version of this, you can see that there is some advance in the field, but it is not as rapid as you might think. There are more and more AI components that find their way into everyday life, mostly unnoticed by the public, but there is still a huge amount of research going on and open problems that need to be solved in the future. So.
To people who are quite perhaps unscientific or certainly not involved in this field and don't know very much about it, it can seem a little bit sinister, the way you say it's creeping into our everyday lives and we don't necessarily notice or know where and how. What do you think when you hear people say it's a bit creepier, it's a bit sinister?
I wouldn't say per se that it is creepy in any way. Where it finds its way into everyday life, it's usually used as a decision helper. You can find it in devices like TV boxes that suggest some programs that you might be interested in by analysing your viewing behaviour. Home automation is the big area at the moment where smart is the buzzword, and not all smart devices are actually smart and use AI, but more and more this is the case, and we will see a lot of AI in these devices that will make our lives easier. by trying to predict what we actually want to do next and by analysing our behaviour. Obviously, there is a risk of the vast amount of data that will be collected and that will be analysed in this way to be abused, and as a society, learned society, we see ourselves in the position that we need to kind of make the public aware of these potential problems. But at the moment, I wouldn't see AI as being sinister at all.
People sometimes, I find, get resistant to the idea of decisions being made for them. But do you see it more as a suggestion rather than a decision? Something, like you say, is a good example, that your Digibox saying, oh, you like this, you might like this as well.
In general, I'd say it's much better at this stage to have suggestions being made to you rather than decisions being taken. But there probably are some areas where decisions need to be taken fairly rapidly, and this is an area where AI can be helpful. If you look at space missions where probes are sent out to planets or meteors, as we've just recently seen, they don't know exactly what to expect. They don't know what the environment's going to be like, and there's no way of directly remote controlling them. So there has to be some sort of intelligence within these machines that we send out to explore for us, to react to the environment that they find.
Back to today, what do you hope people come away from today with in terms of the way they think about AI?
In general, the Turing test itself is a very, very simple way of more excluding some programs from displaying actual intelligence. And my personal opinion is that even if an AI program passes the Turing test, this is not evidence of that program, chatbot, or whatever AI it is, displaying actual intelligence. It is sort of fooling a set of judges on a special occasion into thinking that it is human rather than a machine. To me, that is not all that intelligence has to offer, and I think this is nicely displayed in the structure of the Loebner Prize, because we're still only in the first stage of it, where the communication takes place only textually on a teletype system, whereas if there is a winner of this first stage, we will enter a second stage that adds audiovisual components, and that will get us much, much closer to giving an impression of a human being. But I would still struggle to call a program intelligent just by passing this Turing test type situation.
I hope it goes well and that you're impressed with what you see today.
Thank you very much.
Okay, here's the spreadsheet. Now, judge number one.
The yellow lines here are the choices that the judges have made. So their guess as to what is the computer program rather than...
That's me. I thought the right screen was the computer. Round two, I thought the left screen. Round three, the left screen. And round four, the right screen.
Okay, and the ranking?
I would rank round one computer first, round two computer second, round three computer fourth, round four computer third.
Thank you. Okay, that's it. Now, next...
Rose is the first place winner and therefore wins the bronze medal of this year. Meeting everyone here next year again. And
we could have a date.
Looking forward to someone winning the silver prize so that the competition can get into its second stage that includes more components as well.
Okay, well, very good. Well, thank you. Right.
Thank you, Hugh.
And my thanks to Ed Keedwell.
Can I just thank the judges and the Confederates and the University of Bedfordshire who donated their equipment, and obviously Bletchley Park
and everybody else.
For all their assistance in the contest.
Next year will be the 25th annual Loebner Prize Conference.
Silver anniversary.
How do you feel it's gone?
Yeah, I feel it's gone really well, actually. I'm really pleased with the way the conversations went and the way the contest has gone. It's a nice clear-cut result as well, which is always nice to see.
Can you give me some sort of description of any of the conversations they were having?
I think one of the Confederates talked about the John Lewis penguin advert, so it was quite topical, quite interesting.
And do you see the competition evolving year to year?
Yeah, I think the basics are there. That the sort of fundamental of the contest are there, and those won't change. Of course, Turing's original test and the way we do the sort of the factorial design and things. As you can see, Rose won the best spot this time. it was also the best in selection. So I think that's in some sense an expected result. It did very well in selection. Nearly 90% of the answers were plausible. So yeah, I think it'll be Bletchley hopefully again. You know, it gives us a chance to evolve things a bit more. Yeah.
And it just shows that the Turing test is still really relevant today. This is up-to-the-minute software.
Absolutely, yeah. I think, although obviously none of the bots fooled the judges, it is an incredibly hard test. It's been around for 60-odd years now, and we haven't got close to passing it. So, but, perhaps there was never that expectation that we'd pass it today. But, they're getting closer. Those AI bots, they're getting closer, definitely.
Congratulations. Oh,
thank you. Thanks.
The Imitation Game is not just a film, it's now also an exhibition here at Bletchley Park. Now open in the Mansion Ballroom where the pivotal bar scenes were filmed, this exhibition takes you right inside the making of the film, with costumes, props and the very bar that was built for filming. You can even pose at the table where Alan Turing and Joan Clarke, as played by Benedict Cumberbatch and Keira Knightley, sat and discussed love, friendship and the shortcomings of German Enigma operators. The Imitation Game, the exhibition, was launched with a very special screening of the film here at Bletchley Park.
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, very briefly, for the rest of the evening, the exhibition behind me, which is an exhibition linked to the Imitation Game film, there are props, costumes and other bits and pieces from the film to have a look at, will be open for you to wander around at your leisure. Firstly, thank you for Studio Canal for helping us put on this exhibition. Thank you to Sarah Kay here, who has worked tirelessly on her own, really, for the last 3 or 4 weeks to pull this together. Done a fantastic job. I hope you enjoyed the film. I hope you see what it's going to do for Bletchley Park. We're convinced that the emotional pull in it and the evocative spirit of the era that it's creating is going to drive visitors to our doors in ever-increasing numbers, and we're very grateful to be able to have a preview here tonight. So without further ado, I'm going to use these to cut the red ribbon. Photographer, where do you want me?
Okay, this way.
Sarah Kay, you put together the exhibition of the film The Imitation Game with some of the amazing props which they used in the movie, and we're standing right by them now. How difficult was it to put it all together? I understand things came in boxes and you had to interpret it what they are.
Yeah, we got about 11 boxes. It was quite exciting. It was a bit like Christmas. I had no idea what was in them. But actually, when I opened them and once I'd seen the film, it actually was really easy to put together because the props were fantastic, the film was fantastic, and the room that it was going to be placed in, which is where The Imitation Game filmed, is a beautiful room. So you can't really go wrong.
We're standing right by a couple of props now, the bomb that Alan Turing in the film made. Do you want to tell me a bit about that and some of the other things that you've got here?
Yeah, so the bomb, which was named Christopher in the film, it was kindly donated to us by the film company after use. And I think once it's done with this exhibition, it will go on to become a very valuable part of our collection. And we will certainly use it elsewhere. But it's a beautiful piece of machinery and one that's obviously had a lot of effort put into building. And the scene's obviously just been created to look slightly like Hut 11, or as much as you can make it look like Hut 11 when you're in a ballroom.
Which we are at the moment, where the exhibition is. Well, turning round, there's the bar. They turned this amazing room with this gorgeous ceiling into a pub.
They did. They wow. did indeed. Yeah, so the bar was actually the one that was used in the film, and that's exactly where it was. And this whole room would have been staged with tables and chairs and a dance floor. The actual room that they filmed in, we've just got a miniature version of the pub scene because we obviously wanted to put more content into the room than just having a pub. So you've got a small area where people can sit down and have their photos taken, and then we've also got a set dressed area.
In the room that we had to walk through to get here, there's the costumes worn by Benedict Cumberbatch and Keira Knightley.
Yeah. So we have 4 costumes within the exhibition, 2 of which were worn by Benedict Cumberbatch. One was Keira Knightley's beautiful dress, and another one was Charles Dance's, aka Denniston, his naval uniform that he wore in the film as well. We've used some of the props that the film obviously gave to us. We've also hired things, and we've also had things made purposefully to look, as it were, in the film, such as the bunting.
I've missed the stuff that's in the case in the middle. Yeah. And there is an Enigma machine. Is that a prop from the film? Is that a real one? What is that?
That is a real World War II Enigma. It's kindly come to us via a gentleman called David Cripps. He loaned it to us. Pretty much everything else in the whole exhibition is a prop or something that was used in the film apart from the World War II Enigma.
But it's the real thing.
It is the real
thing. So you can't complain.
No, and we have the largest collection of Enigmas in Europe at Bletchley Park.
How long is this exhibition going to be here?
So the exhibition opens to the public on the 10th of November. So just to gain some excitement before the film's released. And it runs right through to the 1st of November 2015. So just shy of a year.
Okay, good luck with it.
Okay, thank you very much.
Giles English, you're from Bremont, the creators of the Codebreaker watch, which you did in conjunction with Bletchley Park.
Well, we had always been slightly fascinated, myself and my brother who run Bremont, and we'd always been fascinated with Bletchley Park, and we have this history of creating limited edition watches, incorporating famous pieces of history in, and we spoke to Bletchley Park and created the Codebreaker watch with wood from Alan Turing's floorboards, paper from original Hollerith machines, metal from German Enigma rotor, all into a beautiful mechanical watch, and helped raise some money for the restoration here. And it's lovely to be back for the film.
What did you think of the film?
I think it really triggers the emotion. And this whole place is about emotion. What they did is amazing. And to come out of a cinema and to step into Bletchley Park, it really blows you away. And we're totally honoured with our association. I'm totally amazed by what Bletchley Park have done historically, but obviously what they're doing as a museum now. And look at it, tonight, setting up this whole show, it's just wonderful to see.
We should say that we're actually in the exhibition, which relates to the film, and we're looking at the props that they had in the film. Literally, to come out of the film, looking at the props straight away, that's like, wow, I just saw that on the big screen.
Oh, yeah, we're in the stage set here, and I recommend anyone to come along, because it really does sum it up. And I think, obviously, how do you tell the history of Bletchley Park in a two-hour film? It's not impossible. But to get the emphasis of what they achieved. And I think you've got to come down and see this, don't you?
Thank you so much.
Well, thank you very much.
Tom Briggs, your education officer here at Bletchley Park. You're standing right next to a genuine Enigma machine. This was used in the film with Benedict Cumberbatch.
It was. It features quite prominently in a couple of scenes.
And I have to say that even though it is, 70 years old, it's really in good nick. This is why, presumably, it was able to go in the film and look as if it was almost new.
Yes, yeah, it's certainly been taken care of, and it probably didn't see a lot of action in the 1940s, so that's why we're able to use it these days.
Do you think it added to the authenticity of what was happening on screen, but to have a genuine prop there?
Definitely, yes. You can make a replica, but it wouldn't be the real thing, and the hardcore enthusiasts would be able to tell.
And for the actors as well, to have a genuine prop which they were working with, do you think it helped them?
It must have done. I imagine it probably helped to get into character. I met them a couple of times before filming started to give them a run through the Enigma machine, give them a bit of a crash course in how to use it, so they were really familiar with it. So I can't imagine that would have happened if they'd used a replica.
And this machine goes out to schools and you show children how it worked.
It does. My role at the park is education officer, and I'm in charge of the outreach program. So for the last couple of years, I've been going around to schools around the country doing code breaking sessions and teaching them about Enigma and the history of Bletchley Park. It's a wonderful enrichment tool for maths departments especially.
Do you think the film gives some sort of flavour about how difficult it was to crack the code which was coming out one of these Enigma machines?
It really does. It gives a fantastic idea of the unique sort of individual that was suited to working at Bletchley Park and the new way of thinking that was encouraged and that had to be used to come up with these interesting and innovative ideas for breaking the codes that were being made on new and interesting machines.
And it's such a shame that Alan Turing was never able to live to see the recognition in Bletchley Park here that everyone's giving him today.
It is a massive shame, and that's true of so many of Bletchley Park's codebreakers. A lot of them did not have the opportunity to be recognised for the work they'd done here. And I think what this film is going to do is obviously going to get people to know more about not just Alan Turing, but Bletchley Park as a whole and the other people who gave so much to such an important cause.
Well, Jason Gorman, you're a software developer and you do a lot of work for Bletchley Park. Just seeing the film, how do you regard Alan Turing in terms of the development of computing?
Well, as far as people like me are concerned, he's the grandfather of the computing age, so he's a very, very important figure. And a lot of us may understand the technical aspects of some of the work that he did and how key it was as a foundation to what the kind of work I do now. But I think the great thing about this film that we've seen tonight is the emotional element to it. You're drawn into a story which is about a human being at the end of the day, albeit a very amazing human being. And that's something that's quite new. That's not something that we really have any flesh on his bones, as it were. We can read his papers, we can read about him. But to see him brought to life in that way, in such a sympathetic way, in such a dramatic way, I found really exciting. And I barely noticed that my legs had gone to sleep.
He's quite an antagonistic character in the movie. Do you think that's how a lot of intellectuals are?
No. I've met some difficult people in my industry who are very, very clever. No one I would suspect that I've met is as clever as Alan Turing was. He was a mathematician, really, whereas programmers like me kind of stand on the shoulders of giants like Turing rather than, you know, doing that kind of thing ourselves. I've met a few computer scientists who are very important, and they've all been very nice people. We've gone out for lunch and they've all been very pleasant. Most computing academics I've met are actually nice people, but I do understand that what Turing did was a whole different kettle of fish. He essentially created a foundation mathematically for us, as well as, you know, the technical stuff like building electromechanical machines and stuff. Ultimately, it was the thinking thoughts that no one had ever thought before. So I can imagine that he was a very special kind of person.
And it's only now, really, that we can fully appreciate what we did. But for so many years, it was hidden, it was secret, and that's something also brought out in the film.
Yeah, I can understand, and I think it brings it home more. Maybe we could understand. People didn't know that there wasn't going to be another major warp. You can understand the fear that people might find out the work that was done there and that they might abandon things like Enigma, which would have given us a real advantage. No one really saw beyond that. To be fair, I'm not sure that Turing did either. Maybe if he were to see the world as it is today, I think he'd probably be gobsmacked as well at just how ubiquitous computers have become.
David, you're the location manager who worked on The Imitation Game. Mm-hmm. Tell us about your impression of the film.
It's always very difficult when you're part of the filmmaking process to be apart from it, to be just an audience member coming to it for obvious reasons, because for 8 months of my life, that's what we lived the film. From day one of preparation, when I read the script, right through into post-production, where I looked after the what we call a plate unit, where we were doing background shots of the English Channel, that kind of thing, to work with the computer graphic people. So I spent a long time on the film, but I've seen it 4 times now. And the first couple of times, I think you just look at the technical details and work that we did. And also, some of the script changes a little bit in the editing process. So those kind of things you look for. The third time, I really enjoyed it. The fourth time, I was looking back at some, there was no mistakes, but it was just things that perhaps we could have done differently. But overall, I love the film. I'm really proud of it. I'm proud to be a part of it.
What were the challenges in finding the right locations?
We'd always planned to film some smaller sequences at Bletchley Park, perhaps what we call cutaway shots of the machines, and also some atmosphere shots. Bletchley Park itself, the house is lovely, it's of its period. It has a sense of place, and obviously it has this incredible history to it, but it's not terribly cinematic. Cinematic is the word we use. Also, Bletchley is a very busy place. It would be very difficult for us to take over for the weeks that we needed. When I got the script, I came up with some other ideas, and one of them, which took a few weeks to find because it is a hospice, a hospital, so it wouldn't normally be available for filming. But I found this house near Henley called Nettlebed, which was a nice connection. It was where Ian Fleming was born, who obviously one of the prime movies of MI5 and MI6, and obviously wrote the James Bond novels. So that was a nice bit of history, so there was a connection. It had only been used a little bit for filming before, but it seemed to fit the story. But also the interiors that you see in the film, the wood panelled rooms, they're all at location. They're not in studio. We used the whole building and we had incredible help from the hospital themselves to use it. And we were there for 10 days. Again, the huts at Bletchley Park are obviously have a sense of place and history, but they're not terribly cinematic because they're kind of all higgledy-piggledy for obvious reasons. That's how they were built and adapted during the Second World War. We found an RAF base at Bicester that had been decommissioned recently that had the huts in a more uniform, cinematic kind of way of looking, and that's what we used. But in the end, we did use the ballroom at Bletchley Park, which for part of the war was the place where Alan Turing, Joan Clarke and the others would have danced and drank. So that was incredibly important to us and we were very glad to be here. We'd had a last minute change of mind in one of our other locations that we were going to use as the ballroom scene. It didn't quite work out. So I went back to the director and the production designer, Maria, and said, what about Bletchley? It's there. It's a great location. It may be a little smaller for what we wanted, but I came back to Bletchley and spoke to Ian and Kelsey about this, and they said, yeah, please come. So we did, and it was very important for the actors, I think, because they felt such a sense of place, and it really worked out for the benefit of the film in the end.
How important is it for actors, and for this film in particular, to be on the site where history happened?
I think it was incredibly important, and I think it was very important for the actors. The crew also, and the studio and the post-production people, they really saw that it really added something to the film. It just made it more authentic, and I think hopefully that does come through. And it's a lovely connection as well for Bletchley Park Trust themselves and Bletchley Park to be part of this, what should be a great film.
When you cast your location manager eyes on Bletchley Park as it is now, it was very different when the whole process started. Do you get a sense of the time and the place?
Well, I have a long history with Bletchley Park because I actually was the location manager on the Enigma film 12, 13 years ago now in 2001. So I came to Bletchley Park when it looked slightly different than it does now. It wasn't in such a good state because obviously so much renovation has been done in those subsequent years. So I knew Bletchley Park very well and had a connection to it. So I very much felt the sense of place here. I brought the production team in the first day when they came over from the States just to show them the reality. They got it. I think going to Hutt8 and you realise the history, the decisions that were made there, you sense it. You really feel that this little small hut, as it says in the film, it does say a small village in England. We know it's a small town, Bletchley, but you just know the importance of the things that were done there by Alan Turing, by Hugh Alexander, the others. And then to see the other huts where the Turing machines were, the bombs, is incredible. And you don't really take it in. You have to go away and read a little bit, and then perhaps you do. But then obviously films like this will get it out to such a bigger audience.
What are you hoping will the audience take away from watching the film?
I think the audience should take away how incredibly important Alan Turing was and what a genius he was, and how he, and obviously his colleagues too, just saved so many people and literally won the war. Obviously, it would have probably been won in the end, but it just would have taken so much longer. And the country would have been a complete mess, and so many more people would have died.
I'm with Ian Standen and Kelsey Griffin. You two looking very tired after a very long event, but it always seems to be worth it.
Well, as far as I'm concerned, the event went completely as planned. Everybody was blown away by the film. Everybody was blown away by the exhibition. So that's another tick in the box as far as I'm concerned. I don't know about Ian.
Yeah, absolutely. It's added another dimension to Bletchley Park as a heritage attraction story. We've now got this film which is going to reach out to another audience that we probably don't touch at the moment, who are interested in people like Benedict Cumberbatch and Keira Knightley as actors and actresses, who are going to go and see the film and suddenly realise there's a place called Bletchley Park they didn't know anything about. And hopefully it's going to encourage them to go and find out more. And of course, ultimately to come and visit the site here and walk in the footsteps of the Codebreakers.
It's just another way of telling the story, isn't it? With everything we do here, it's to tell the story of all the people who were here during the war and served here.
Absolutely. Museum interpretation touches all sorts of different levels. It's aimed at all sorts of different audiences, and we try and provide something for everybody. And here, somebody else is providing another entree to the Bletchley Park story through the medium of a feature film. A feature film that's very well made, in my opinion, that tells a fantastic, heart-wrenching in places story, and one that really evokes the spirit of the Second World War, and more particularly the work of Bletchley Park.
I think you were saying, Kelsey, there was a screening for volunteers yesterday, wasn't there? And the people at the end of the film were in tears.
Yeah, and these are people that are immersed in this subject matter on a daily basis and have been for, in some cases, very many years. And yeah, absolutely, the film was so powerful that at the end, a number of people were moved to tears. And to take that one step further, quite a number of people said to me tonight that coming out of the film, out of the teleprinter hall, and then coming up to the mansion for the reception was incredibly moving. They felt as though they were coming out of the film onto the film set, which they found quite emotional.
It's such a coup that Bletchley have managed to get here, getting so much from the film I mean, all the detail that they went into, the paperwork and the passes and things like that, it's amazing that we've got all of this stuff, isn't it?
Yeah, it's great collateral, and you know, like any of these films, when you're getting the detail that they do, they have to produce all this stuff, so you know, it's great that we've managed to corral it all here, bring it all in, and put this exhibition on, which tells really how you make a feature film built around a historic story and how you need all these props that make it look authentic. Yes, it's a feature film, and often in making feature films you have to be economical with the truth, and you have to, you know, create fictional characters and boil things down and
you have to make composites.
Yeah, exactly. You have to be able to make it accessible in a two-hour feature film, but what's around it is all the paraphernalia that really gives the spirit and feel of the period, which is, you know, which is so nice.
And that will hopefully draw people here to find out the real story, won't it?
And to find out the stories of the other people that are perhaps not mentioned in the film, because it wouldn't be realistic to tell everybody's story in the space of 2 hours. So what people can do is now come here and learn about the other stories.
You're trying to build your universal machine? I read your paper at university.
Is it already being taught?
No, I was precocious. So, you theorised a machine that could solve any problem. It didn't just do one thing, it did everything. It wasn't just programmable, it was reprogrammable. Is that your idea behind Christopher?
Well, human brains can compute large sums very quickly. Even Hugh can do that, but I want Christopher to be smarter. To make a calculation and then to determine what to do next. Like a person does. Think of it. Electrical brain. A digital computer.
Digital computer?
Benedict Cumberbatch spoke exclusively to Bletchley Park about how nerve-wracking it was filming pivotal scenes here at the home of the Codebreakers and fictionalising parts of the story. He's spoken passionately about the importance of the story of Alan Turing and his many colleagues. But to us, he talked about what filming at Bletchley Park itself added to the film. We can now bring you the full interview with the man who played Turing.
Are you paying attention?
Based on the incredible true story.
Who are you?
Alan Turing.
It's an instant classic.
Welcome to Enigma.
It's unbreakable.
A superb thriller, 5 stars.
What if only a machine can defeat another machine?
Enigma will not save you.
You've got more secrets than the best of them.
The Imitation Game, in cinemas now.
What did you think?
Are we ready?
What did you think?
Yes, we are now.
Oh, fantastic.
Did you enjoy it?
Yes, very much.
Oh, good.
Brilliant.
Have lots of Bletchley Park people seen it yet? Or
yes. Yeah, everybody loves it.
Yes?
Yes.
Oh, that's such a relief.
So, of course, I want to know what it was like filming at Bletchley Park.
Amazing. It was amazing. I mean, what an extraordinary experience. I mean, obviously, as you guys know, I went around there a couple of times for research, and you were amazing. You opened doors and were so patient with, struggling actor's brain to try and sort of encompass what cryptography really is and what really happened there and how the bomb works and the machine you see behind me, which we give a different name in the film, but that's basically a model of the bomb. And to work in the environs where all this happened, where the people breathed, lived, loved, worked, struggled, kept secrets, were heroic, quietly, stoically, was really, really overwhelming. It was a very important part of the film. I think it wouldn't have felt right not to have had a moment with Bletchley Park featuring properly. And, while there have been many changes, obviously, to how it is to film the whole of it now would be anachronistic to the storyline of what it was like then, obviously. The parts that we were able to feature that were Bletchley were just magic moments in the filming sort of schedule. It really was very special. You feel, however brilliant, and Maria is really seriously brilliant as a designer. I've worked with her before Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy. And she can do something with nothing. She really, really can. Every single time she creates these extraordinary worlds. But two things. When you're on a set, you know, after the brilliance of that wears a little bit, you realise, you go out for your cup of coffee and it's just a flat and a weight propping up a sort of bit of wood. And, the work sort of goes into that being in your periphery, apart from what's maybe right in front of you. In Bletchley Park, everywhere you looked, you realised that this was the architecture, this was the sky, some of the trees being there way before any of them were even there. And it adds something to nothing. You really feel that you're playing slightly with ghosts as well. So it's nerve-wracking, it is, because you think, Christ, we're fictionalising what really happened here. But at the same time, we got so much of a blessing from you guys, and we can't thank you enough, you know, and I'm just thrilled to have featured Bletchley as we did.
And you must feel quite a responsibility portraying a real character, yeah. Especially someone who's within living memory.
Yeah, and also living memory, but not recorded memory, not in any kind of visual filmic form or audio form. So his very distinct mannerisms, his voice, his speech pattern and pitch, you know, these were things that were counted. And obviously then there is the matter that this is a film. And if I did it to the extreme that Anna apparently did have his stammer, did have his high pitch as well on the stammer, it would have been very hard, I think, to tell the story and keep the momentum of the film going. And yet, you know, it's his legacy. It's really important. So what I beg people to sort of realise is this, I would only ever say, is a sort of a touchstone, just a beginning, an impression, an idea of the man, an imitation even, to coin a pun. But, you know, not as such in the sense that he was physically there for me to talk to and ask questions and observe in behaviour, but... Or even through, you know, recordings. But just because he was somebody who, after a while of playing him, it really did get under my skin. I had a huge love of the man. So it matters to me deeply that we've portrayed something of an accurate nature of his personality as well as the story. And thankfully, the Turing family had a screening the other week and gave it the thumbs up. They were thrilled. And that's, with you guys as well, is hugely important. You know, there are people that have a much more intimate knowledge of him and have written incredible biographies, such as Andrew Hodges. And their work should be something that people could take on after watching this film. And again, the reams of brilliant books written about Hut 8 and all the work that happened at Bletchley Park as well. And I would suggest people do that. It was a fascinating open door of discovery to delve into that world that's now more public domain than it has been in the past.
Just finally, how yes. important is it, do you think, that Bletchley Park is kept alive and accessible to people?
Hugely important. Hugely important. I mean, that was the environment where men and women from all walks of society, from all abilities, whether it be actors and artists to the more likely candidates of mathematicians and physicists and scientific thinkers, came together to try and crack a code that was basically, or many codes actually, that were... the encryption devices of the Nazis, and they were winning the war. The country was starving. The clock was ticking, as is portrayed in the sort of pacing thriller element of our film. And to understand the importance of that is also to understand the importance of those men and women and the actual environments of where it happened. So to experience something of that through the extraordinary exhibits and explanations you get, both of the working environment and the tools, the actual... You can see the machine, you can hear the machine working, one of the earliest computers working, and it's amazing. You think from that came a reading of a code that basically won us the Second World War, some estimate by 2 years, and that meant millions of lives were saved. And it was all done in secret, and now we can look at that secret. So how could that not be one of the most important legacies we have in our culture of that era? It's incredibly important that it keeps going, incredibly important that it's open to the public and something that's well-funded and supported and continues, because this is our history.
Thank you. That's pleasure. Lovely.
Book now to avoid disappointment as Bletchley Park lines up another year packed with fascinating and fun events. Bletchley Park Presents returns with another lineup of superb speakers, including authors Michael Smith, Jerry White, Taylor Downing and Sinclair Mackay, to name but a few. The 1940s boutique reopens for one-day workshops steeped in vintage glamour. And there's more events than ever before to help children cut their code-breaking teeth, including the Easter Extravaganza and Family Fun Wednesdays throughout the summer. Kathleen Wing was called up in 1944. She joined the ATS Royal Signals and worked as an intercept operator until the end of the war. But just as everyone was finding out how successful the D-Day operation had been, Kathleen received tragic news from home. At the Veterans Reunion this year, she told her story to Bletchley Park researcher and podcast roving reporter, Kerry Howard.
In 1943, I was 20, and I was called up, and I had to go into the service. I was sent to Pontefract, the ATS, to do 6 weeks initial training. At the end of the 6 weeks training, where we'd learnt how to square bash and just about everything else. And then they showed us this film of all the jobs we could do. And I was already a girl guide, and when I saw a snap of somebody sitting taking a wireless message down, I knew that that was what I would try for. I thought to myself, if they've taken me into the army, I'm not going to be a shorthand typist. I didn't fancy being a driver like Elizabeth. Then, of course, they checked out my family.
Yeah.
And they sent me to the Isle of Man. We had to do training till we got up to the right speed. We did an awful lot of Morse, obviously, but to keep our interest, we learnt about the heavy side layer and things that, you know, would stop signals coming over the top. And we learnt all about the aerials, those kinds of things.
Oh, wow, yeah.
Yeah, and because we did an awful lot of PE in those times, and we had male sergeant major, and he used to take us up to where the Italian camp was. We used to be marched down there because our sergeant major used to want to show us off, you know, make us do about turn, come back again, and all these things.
And how long was your training?
Well, that went on until December, because we went home on leave in the November, and the sea was so rough. And I know one time we were coming back to the island, we had to leave from Fleetwood then because they'd stopped the boats from going from Liverpool. So we went on a boat called the Snaefell, and it took 4 hours to get over to the island. I was all right. I wasn't sick until I smelt everybody else being sick, and then I saw the town of Douglas. That was going up and down, so then my head was over the side.
Was this your first time away from home?
Oh, yes.
And how did you find that sort of aspect of it?
I didn't mind because I was the eldest of four children, and it was just exciting. My father was most upset because he took me to St Pancras, and one of the other girls said, as the train drew out, he cried. They didn't know what they were sending their daughters to, did they?
It was such a period of unknown, wasn't
yeah.
it?
Yeah. I went in as innocent as anything. And I came out as innocent as I went in because they were such marvellous girls I was with. You know, I know one of the girls was the daughter of the squire somewhere, you know. And so when we were on duty, we did our job.
When you say on duty, where were you stationed?
Forest Moor, which was Harrogate, 10 miles outside Harrogate, I think. And the girl I shared my bunk with, she was into Gilbert and Sullivan. She used to go to Oxford, to the New Theatre, Oxford, and there was a doily cart place there, and she knew all the words, so we all learned all the words of a lot of them. And we had a kind of a club too. We each paid 6 months a week into this club, and when it was our turn, we drew out of our hat, we could choose a record of our choice, because they were records then, hard ones, you know. But I never got to choosing one, because on D-Day, I went on duty on D-Day, and got there at 7 o'clock in the morning. When I think of what we had to do before we went on duty, and the person I took over from, she said, I don't know what's happened, but the Germans are sending plain language. So immediately we guessed, and I went to coffee in the Naffy, and I heard that there'd been a landing. Then we came off duty at 1 o'clock. I had our dinner, and we're all very excited. And, of course, we'd had to barricade our beds, like we had to make them into square packs in the mornings before we went on duty. And when we came off, we had to remake our beds. So there we were, remaking the beds. I was in the top bunk. Marie was at the bottom. And we're singing Deutschland, Deutschland, über alles. We were 20-year-olds and 21-year-olds, weren't we? Then we had to hop into bed again because we had to go on duty again at midnight. But I never got there. I just dropped off to sleep, and office came and whispered into my ear, your mother's died. Get dressed, go over to company office, pass waiting for you. And transport's laid on. So that was it. I was whisked off through London, where all traffic had been stopped, red caps all around. Got back to home, and of course, my father was so devastated because she was only 46, I think. What had happened? She'd had operation about a week before, and I'd been down to London. They'd let me have a day off to go and visit her. But, of course, they wanted to get them out of hospital quickly. and they didn't treat them right today. Had she been a patient today, they're keeping the legs moving the whole time. So she died of pulmonary embolism. But I still had to stay in the army, and they sent me down to Shenley so I could get home every 3 days because we worked 6 hours on, 12 hours off. We did that for 72 hours, and then we had 36 hours off. We used to come off at midnight, so during that 36 hours, I'd go home early in the morning, go up to London.
And at what point did you realise what your part in the whole sort of process
actually,
was?
We were only told our messages came to BP. It was a mansion in the country. We weren't told where it was or any size. We just thought it was army. We know because we were taking down army stuff. Obviously, we had to sign the Official Secrets Act right at the very beginning. So nobody ever talked about it. We had sparks inside of our uniforms. We wore the Royal Signals badge on, yeah. And so that was it. We were Royal Signals. We just never talked about it. We just got in the habit. You know, we'd almost forgotten. And so it must have been more than 30 years afterwards. We were watching television and suddenly came up. And I said to my husband, oh, that's what I did. And of course, by that time, my father died. And he would have loved to have known what I'd done. But there we are.
Yeah.
Yes.
And what about coming back to Bletchley? Sort of coming to Bletchley?
First time was 1998. We came, a party came from Downham Market, where I lived. And then one or two other parties came from Downham Market. And they all said, oh, it's all about the code breakers and nothing about your wireless operators. So I set to on my laptop, and I did that in a month. And that was published and republished. And then when I moved to Brandon 8 years ago, there was a printer that just printed the extra copy.
I'm going to get a copy myself.
Oh, you hope so.
And yeah. I'll put a link to it on my website as well.
Oh, good.
Can you give us the title?
Yes, Two Vic Eddies and Away We Go. Two Vic Eddies. And that means that all the messages started with Vicks. They come up, da-da-da-da, da-da. You could almost imagine them waking up in the morning, you know, da-da-da-da, da-da-da. But when the messages were coming over, it always came over, da-da-da-da, da. That's a Vic and the Eddie, da-da-da-da, V, da-da-da, E, da-da-da, 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 and then you get D and some call sign. It would be Fuhrer. D something, D A from another D and two letters. And then you get the NR number, the number of the message. Then after that, you got da 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 da. And then off you went on these five blocks, according to the weather. You know, now you know how television blocks, sometimes the messages will go very quiet in the summer, they fade away. But we had a Q code, like Vincent QSB was fading. QRV, a shortened way of them sending, are you ready for a message? QSA was, how strong was it, the signal? I've got all the Q codes at home. And we were told we had to pick up the three digits for the weather forecast. We were told it was the weather forecast. We didn't know it was the way the rotors changed for the day. We were so innocent, you know. And because it was on a need-to-know basis.
And you still remember the Morse?
I still remember, yes, in fact. The day after the publication, because I sent some down to the local bookshop, and a letter was put through my door, addressed all in Morse code, and then I saw it all Morse code, and I thought, oh, I hope I'm going to be able to interpret this.
Thank you very much for taking the time to speak to me.
Oh,
today.
Thank you. It sounds an awful lot of rubbish, but...
No, it's absolutely fascinating. I enjoyed it very much. It is what our listeners want to hear.
Oh, good, yes.
Thank you.
Thanks to the paid and volunteer staff, veterans and visitors who took part in this podcast. For more information, go to bletchleypark.org.uk, find us on iTunes and Twitter, where we are at BPark Podcast, and join our Facebook group. Thanks to Audio Boom, who make this podcast possible. This podcast is produced for the Bletchley Park Trust by MC Fontaine. And if you like the Bletchley Park podcast, don't be shy, write a review on iTunes.
Thanks for listening, and we'll have more decrypts from the home of the Codebreakers next month.